I want to thank our panel for being here. As you all know, big news on the Clean Power Plan or the Paris Accord or Scott Pruitt's travel will probably break while we're up here. So if you see our panelists suddenly captivated by their phones, something's happening. I told them they could have their phones because, you know, y'all know what the news cycle is like these days. So there's a lot to be said about covering this new administration, from the handling of natural disasters to the undoing of environmental regulations, to the selection of top administration officials who have in the past been outright hostile to the government agencies that they're now overseeing. There's also the broader issue of how the administration treats the press, both publicly and in one-on-one situations. So I won't waste time and get to our panel. We have an esteemed group of panelists here who have a lot to talk about. Our first panelist is Lisa Friedman, who's a reporter on the climate desk at the New York Times. We have Brady Dennis, a national reporter for the Washington Post. Stephen Curwood, who's executive producer and host of Public Radio International's Living on Earth. Emily Holden, who covers energy and climate change at Politico. Peter Stern, a senior reporter at the Freedom of Press Foundation and the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. And Michael Biesecker, an investigative reporter with the Associated Press. So let me just jump right in. We'll start with Lisa. So you've all been reporters for some time. How does this compare to covering previous administrations?
That's an easy one. Well, I mean, so look, I think I might actually start a little counterintuitively. I mean, we all know that this is, you know, an incredibly secretive and closed administration. You know, 9 months in, it's you know, incredibly difficult to get basic schedules. I'm not even talking about the calendars that you've seen us reporting on recently, but, you know, schedules for the week of where cabinet secretaries are going and speaking. And, you know, many of us on the panel have been subject to personal attacks for our stories, and I'm sure folks in the audience perhaps too. On the other hand, you know, I think one of the things that I've noticed is that because there is a level of divisiveness and disorganization, there are so many opportunities for stories and so many opportunities to talk to different types of people within the agencies and within the administration on stories. You know, I would say that to me the big difference between covering this administration and the Obama administration, just in terms of sort of access and ability to get stories, is that there was an incredibly organized top-down system of delivering information to journalists that it was very hard to break through with the Obama administration. And things are all over the place right now. And so if you can try and get all over the place, you can get a lot of good stories. There's so I think I'll stop there and we can come back to that. But that's
I totally agree with Lisa. And I would say, you know, we should, even though it's a very different world right now, we should note that the Obama administration wasn't exactly the most open and helpful in a lot of ways. But it's a totally different world. Everything before flowed through the White House, and the White House controlled the message, and everyone deferred to the White House, and the White House was the center of the universe when it came to policy in Washington. And now it's this series of fiefdoms with you know, personalities at the top of them, and they have their own people with them and their own universe, and they don't necessarily answer to anyone at the White House, or they occasionally do, or some days you're not sure. And so, like Lisa said, it's much more important to be involved and have sources and understand each individual agency for what it is, because they're all very different places to cover right now.
I have to agree with both, but let me give a little historical perspective, because I'm old enough to do that, I guess. So when I was a young reporter at the Boston Globe, this is the time in the Nixon administration, had an enemies list, and my friend Dan Shore was on that list. And that White House crowd was really chilling. This White House crowd, as we know, has problems with truth, accuracy, fairness, timeliness. They don't know what the hell they're doing. I mean, that's the basic problem. So as Brady points out, there are these places that you could get information. The good news about this, as horrible as the flow of information is out of this government, is that at a more local level and with kind of local bureaucrats, or in my case, I've spent a lot of time with scientists who are trying to get their work done, they will talk. except they know that they're working for an organization that if it ever gets out that they talked, they will lose various body parts. So it's tragic that we're at this level right now in this country. I mean, this is not normal, folks. We should not be talking about this as a normal journalism problem. When people are being hauled off, deported from the country, there's something going on where I'm from in the Northeast with Indonesians who came here, they're suddenly being deported. When people are being deported basically on the basis of their skin color, their ethnicity, or their backgrounds, I mean, the last time I saw this in history was in, you know, what, the early days of the 30s in Germany, before World War II. So these are not normal times. And I just would encourage everybody here to say, okay, it's not a normal time. We're not going to get the normal responses. Sources, if they're good, are really at risk, really at risk, and to move accordingly. And we as the press are so valuable at this point. The reason that they're trying to ice us all the time is that, you know, we purvey the truth, and that does not work for them.
I think I would agree with a lot of what Lisa said, but add that there's a flip side to that, right, where there is a lot of division, especially within the White House and within agencies, but you have to be very careful with what you're hearing because sometimes a certain interest wants you to write a particular sort of story to advance their cause, and so you have to have a really strong network of people to check that with, to gut check that with, and so a lot of what I've been relying on is, you know, not just the White House or the agencies, but the people that they talk to, the stakeholders, the think tanks, a lot of the conservative interest groups, a lot of the industry groups, people who I can say, look, this doesn't have to be on the record at all. Just tell me straight, is this actually happening? Is this real? Should I even pursue this story?
I would have to agree with what everyone has said about the difference between sort of the political leadership of these agencies and then the actual bureaucrats, how they're willing to talk, but they're also at an immense risk. And that means that we, as journalists, need to really make sure that we are protecting our sources and do so in a way that maybe historically or in previous administrations, national security reporters would have had to do when you're talking to people in intelligence agencies who are leaking classified information. Now, even just talking to bureaucrats and career officials, I think, because this administration is so sensitive to leaks, even if they don't imperil national security or anything like that, you need to make sure that you are protecting your confidential sources in a way that maybe you didn't have to under previous administrations.
Well, I would say that this administration is obviously different. I've only been reporting from the comforts of Washington for a couple years. But, you know, organizations take on the characteristics of their leaders. And here we have a president who has declared us enemies of the people, who does not value freedom of the press, does not respect the role we play in a democracy. And the people working in his cabinet agencies have sort of taken on that mantle. They're extremely aggressive towards us. They push back on everything, even things that are factually accurate. And they cast out terms like fake news for anything that they don't feel suits their agenda. So you sort of have to gear up. You have to armor up to cover this administration. And we're still figuring out how to do it. But, you know, there's good strategies for sourcing. I would say the top one is if EPA calls you an enemy, you'll be better sourced in the agency. Suddenly there's the rank and file will be more inclined to talk to you than maybe they were before.
Yeah, my next question kind of follows up on that. I think Lisa made this point when we were chatting earlier about how, you know, we all had our sources in the past. We had, you know, Republicans that we knew we could call up and they were in our Rolodex and they were the Republicans we knew who we could talk about environmental stuff topics with. And then this administration came in and that Rolodex doesn't really work anymore. It's a whole different class, a group of people from a lot of them from outside Washington entirely. So how is that affecting like your source building, or how are you building new source networks? And then on the other side of that, how are you protecting your sources and protecting your source networks differently?
Sure, I mean, I'll talk about the building sources. I mean, I think I can speak for a lot of reporters, you know, who cover Washington. I think when this administration started, those of us who cover energy and environment realized, wow, we have to go out and get to know a whole lot of more people, that, you know, there is, there are, like you said, you know, there are Republican energy policy experts and lobbyists that we have turned to for years for, you know, an alternate perspective during the Obama years, and they were not always that. You know, I mean, this is a drain the swamp administration, and you know, and a lot of the people that the administration brought in during the transition, particularly, not all of them, you know, in the agencies now, but were folks that we did not seek out as much from, you know, whether it was from Heartland or CEI that we might go to occasionally for, you know, for a comment here or there, but they weren't deep in our network of people that we went to understand how things were proceeding. And now a lot of these folks are part of the establishment in Washington. And so I think it took a big overhaul, you know, I know for my part of, you know, kind of being methodical and figuring out, like, okay, who do I need to get to know now? If I want to, you know, if I want to understand what this administration is doing and where they want to take, for example, the EPA, who do I need to get to know that I never did before? And that's just been an ongoing series of, you know, every week, like lunches and coffees and you know, and I think it's a good lesson to journalists, and, you know, I mean, recognizing that, you know, yes, as you say, there's nothing normal about this administration, everything is different, but it's also a good lesson that, you know, we do get entrenched in the go-to people of our sources, and, you know, so I think this was helpful as a wake-up call to recognize that there are a lot of perspectives out there, and any one of them could join the administration at any time, and we need to beef up our Rolodexes.
I agree, and I'll just add to that. I think it's important to try to understand the new administration, the new group, and where they're coming from. You know, normal or not normal, they are in power. And so I think when it comes to environmental coverage and broader political coverage, you know, you need to read Breitbart News, and you need to watch the interviews that Scott Pruitt and Ryan Zinke and others are giving with conservative outlets, and read those. You need to read some of the associations and institutes that Lisa mentioned. Read what they're writing online and on their blog and what they're proposing. I mean, it's you have to understand that side of things as well to cover it, and it is a good to always do that. On sourcing in general, I would just say, more than ever, you meet people where they are, and that can be literally at night. It can be figuratively on a private messaging app. It could be, you know, on email. It can be at a coffee shop. It can be at all hours of the day, and is at all hours of the day. But that's what it now requires to kind of stay as plugged in as you can.
Yeah, I think what both have said are really important. Especially looking at how these folks are talking to themselves through Fox, through Breitbart, and all that, because it's fairly informative. And then there are these sort of right-of-center think tanks that have an internal consistency and sanity, and they are as alarmed as other folks as to what's going on. And discreetly talking with them, you can get a lot of information. You know, we just don't focus on what's going on environmental change in Washington, show that I do, Living on Earth, but looking around the nation, indeed the world. And in localities, there's really good sources from more local newspapers. So if you look at the Atlanta newspaper, you look at the Nashville newspaper, you look at the Cleveland newspaper, you can get interesting leads and insights about certain government issues and how stuff is being handled with the Trump administration as it comes down. I mean, as an example, you know, Kasich, governor of Ohio, is in some of his fights has been very useful, and that organization has been very useful in kind of pinpointing some folks that can be helpful. But again, they aren't terribly talkative. This is the government of the United States, so it's really important for us to stay on it, but the United States means that there are 50 entities. We'll talk about Puerto Rico later. There are 50 governing entities that also have really interesting stories to tell, interesting resources, and it's a good place to go knocking on doors if you're getting them constantly slammed at you in Washington.
I would agree, and I would say that a lot of the agency heads are telling a very different story in the states than they're telling in Washington, and that's very important for us to be covering, especially for anyone who we think might be running for a higher office later on, because I think that can have a big impact on how they talk and what they do and the political story, not just the policy story, which is also very important. I think part of this is coming back to some basic reporting skills. Some of it is reinventing the wheel. But one thing that I think has been helpful for me is to reach out to sources, even if I don't know what help they might be to me at all later on, before I need something from them. It's just, you know, a basic being a good human, I guess, and building that relationship so that they know, they think of you when they hear something, and they'll tell you, you'll tell them when you hear something, and it might not always pan out, but at least you know that you have someone thinking of you when they're in the right room at the right time, and you're not going to have to call them and say, hey, I need this scoop, you need to give this to me. Because a lot of these people have not really worked with reporters, especially mainstream reporters or trade publications or you know, people who are really on this high level of detail in this way before. So we have to build a certain amount of trust with them.
Yeah, I think what you said, and kind of going back to what Lisa said earlier, this idea that in previous administrations, particularly in the Obama administration, there was this very well-oiled machine. People were used to leaking things. It was almost very institutionalized. And especially if you're looking at some of the state level or local level things, you're dealing with people who, you know, don't just have reporters on speed dial who, when they are considering a policy or to implement something, will leak it as a matter of course. You're kind of doing more like what normal local reporters do, not what DC reporters do, I think.
I come from a news organization where the Obama administration seized our phone records with a secret warrant. Not just an extension, not just a couple extensions, the entire Washington Bureau's phone records, and we didn't find out about it for 2 years. So this environment, with the new administration, obviously the president denounces leakers of all stripes, even those who are just giving basic information or answers to questions. I could tell you that I run into at agencies, sources that you used to call, say, I cannot talk to you. If they find out I've talked to you, you know, I'll lose my job. There's a chilling effect throughout government of people wanting to share information and being concerned about being exposed to sources. So it's incumbent upon us as journalists to take extra precautions in protecting those sources. Y'all probably remember that recently a source was exposed because of dots embedded from a laser printer. So you have to be really conscious of all the ways that that it could come back on a source if they help you or give you a document. I think most of us are using encrypted messaging apps now, probably encrypted email. You do in-person meetings. We had to learn as beat reporters from the reporters at AP that have been covering agencies that deal in classified information, the people that cover CIA, people that, you know, cover NSA. The precautions that they've been taking for years, we now have to take as a company, and that includes maybe leaving your phone. It sounds paranoid, but leaving your phone when you go to a sensitive meeting. You know, the Attorney General has made no bones about using the apparatuses at his disposal to search down and expose leakers. So it's a chilling time for employees, but again, all the more important that we meet them where they are, as Brady said.
So I had a question about the kind of flip side of the leaks, which is, I think Emily mentioned it a little bit earlier, which is that sometimes you now get leakers who are leaking because they have an agenda and they're trying to influence the president or White House policymakers by leaking to reporters. It's this weird circle of leaks situation. So how are you dealing with that and determining like what's a leak of an actual information of what's happening in policy versus what's an agenda leak?
For the record, it's always an agenda leak.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think the difference is, specifically on climate policy, you know, is it a there's a certain two people, it seems, in the White House who care about it and others who don't, allegedly. So, you know, deciding whether the information is administration policy or not. Leaks have always, yes, obviously always been
Does the administration have a coherent policy? I mean, is there really this distinction between agenda leaks and actual policy leaks? Because if the president can be influenced by what is reported in the media, then maybe something will not be policy, and then you'll report it, and then it will become policy. That's certainly why they're leaking to you.
Right. This is the question. So how do we deal with this?
To be honest, I'm not even sure that we should call them leaks, because really this is just how we did our job previously, right? We would talk to people in agencies, we would talk to people at the White House, and we would report that out. Excuse me. I think that it's a little bit of three-dimensional chess, right? Anytime you're getting, and this is, we already know this, really, but anytime you're getting a tip from someone who has to be an anonymous source, think about why they would tell you that. Right? Are they just complaining? Do they just want to see bad stories about the person they work for because they're mad at them? Are they trying to push something forward? And then call the people that you need to call who could give you background on that too, and really try to sort that out and think about, we have to think about more than ever, you know, what role is our reporting playing in how policy is made and what the political story is. And also, we have to be more careful than ever, because any little mistake is going to be held against us and held up as an example for the entire reporting community.
Even if you don't make a mistake, it will be held against you.
Lisa, you said, I think you said.
Oh, no, I was just looking. But, I mean, I guess, you know, taking it away from leaks, I mean, if you're talking about how do you report on a divided administration, I think the story is the division, right? And you were referring, I mean, I'll just like say what you're referring to when it comes to, like, are we in or out of Paris? Are we going to stay in Paris or not in Paris? You know, everyone who covers the administration from Washington, you know, we, you know, knows that there is a small group of people who are working towards keeping the United States ultimately in the Paris Agreement. What I would think all of us still don't know, and what we're all trying to report on consistently is, how widespread is this? How much influence do they have? Does anyone else care? You know, is it, you know, is there any actual work being done? And so it is, you know, because, you know, the division is the story, but it's also what makes telling the story so hard, because it is difficult to say what the administration plans to do when, as a reporter, it becomes increasingly clear to us that, that they might not be sure.
I think, Emily, you said something about, like, the circular situation where you ask someone about something and then it comes back to you and you're not sure if you might have accidentally started
right.
the rumor by asking about it in the first place.
The echo chamber, right? Like, I will say, hey, have you heard this? And my source will say, let me check. And then I'll talk to another source and say, have you heard this? And they'll say, actually, someone just asked me about that. And then I have to wonder, well, was it the person I talked to, or was it another reporter? You know, like, even, I mean, this was even happening last night. I think a lot of us are trying to figure out when exactly the Clean Power Plan is coming out, and how, and, like, what the announcement will be like. And all of my sources were saying, I've heard this from three people now, but no one could really confirm anything.
That's the downside, perhaps. But there's an upside of us asking officials about things that we know about, and that being something that, the press is asking us about this. For example, the other day we saw this science story that the tropical forests are now a net source of carbon in the carbon flux, not a net sink, but a net source. So, and of course the reason is that we never really looked at degradation before. We just looked at where trees had been cut down and kind of measured that, but now we realize that they're weak. So, asking that question of various officials who might be dealing with this is a good way to put it in the discussion. In fact, over the years as a journalist, I have felt often that the question that I've asked or my organization has asked that we haven't, you know, broadcast has been as important as something that we did end up broadcasting, because it got people thinking, on notice, the discussion level moved forward in those agencies or on the Hill or whatever. Press is looking at this and caring about it. So, yes, But I think what you're talking about is especially a problem, though, in this new 24-hour news cycle, because it's real easy to, you know, hit the can at 3 in the afternoon, and then at 4 in the afternoon, somebody else is rushing to get this on, and it's in somebody's blog or whatever, and it's a little bit, this stuff doesn't get a chance to marinate. So this is a double-edged sword. Really important for us to ask these hard questions of folks who are in a position to know or who should know. And you commented on the Paris thing. So it's a bit absurd about whether or not we're in or out of Paris at this moment because of the way the agreement is set up. So it's all about sort of optics, and I think this is a scientific term called BS, about whether or not we're going to be in it at this point. So it's just careful not to to overstate anything. Thanks, Brady. Thanks.
I mean, what is the relationship in this administration particularly between policy that is announced or floated and actual action?
Right. Well, this is actually a question that I was going to ask next, which is a problem that I've found, is that how do you engage readers long-term on this? Because you'll have a leak that something is coming, and then there's an announcement that a thing is going to happen, and then there's an announcement that the announcement is going to happen, and by the time the actual thing happens, you've been covering it for weeks, and you've kind of lost the attention and steam of readers about that issue. And then on the flip side, the news cycle is so fast, and now a second day story is a 5 o'clock story, and by the time we get to the next day, you're on to another story entirely, so you've lost, really, really important stories have gotten lost. So how are you trying to like keep readers engaged on the things that are really crucial subjects on your beat?
Focus more on impacts. Focus on human impacts. How do these policy changes affect people? You know, if there's more mercury in the air, how's that affect fish? If it's smog, childhood asthma. I try not to get caught up in the mill of, okay, Pruitt announced that he's doing a 90-day delay on this rule, and then in 90 days he's going to announce that he's going to write a new rule. That sort of process does not interest readers as much as what does this mean to me. So I spend a lot of time trying to think about where can we go in the country, who can I partner with to show the human impacts of these policies. And when you look at what they say, in the case of Scott Pruitt saying that cleaning up Superfund sites is his top priority, well, let's look at what he's doing with Superfund sites. You know, the president announced a 30% budget decrease. Scott Pruitt says, well, we'll still do more with less because we'll be so much more efficient and we'll manage it so much better. So who does he appoint to put in charge of that? Well, his buddy who just got kicked out by the FCC from running a bank in Oklahoma due to a secret allegation. We don't know really what it was, but apparently he imperiled his fiduciary duties at the bank, and he comes to Washington, and now he's put in charge of Superfund. So looking at who is in charge of these policies, again, the difference between what they say they're doing and what they're actually doing, I think those are where the best stories lie with this administration.
I just couldn't agree more with that, and I think everybody up here has done some of that to some extent. I think our highest service is showing how the actions that are taking place in Washington, how the ripple effects play out around the country. And to the Superfund thing, I mean, when Scott Pruitt first started talking about that, he kept mentioning this site in St. Louis, Westlake, this, and we're going to, you know, they've waited forever, which is true, and I'm going to fix that. So I just went to Westlake, and these people are like, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. We haven't heard from anyone. And, you know, so the actions don't always match the words. We could talk about various examples of that, but I think that's probably the most important thing we could do as journalists.
You mean that dump is still burning in Westlake, and it's still radioactive and
yes.
All that? Funny thing about
Shocking.
That. Kate, I want to raise an interesting a topic here that I think is unique to this administration in its, they make no secret of it. And this is the question of racism and especially the environment. You know, racism, what's the gain for people who are being racist? Just think for a moment. It's a way really to, in my view, to mask abusiveness. And when you put isms on people, you're at the same time you want to abuse them because and gain some sort of advantage. And we've seen consistently, and this is a really good environmental story, we've seen consistently how this administration has taken a racist approach to all kinds of things. I mean, right now, for example, in Puerto Rico, it's a disaster. It's really quite difficult situation there. And Trump's visit there made it very clear that, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, Puerto Rico. Right, let me throw you some towels, guys. I'm sure you need those. And this is a there's a terrific opening to get in there and to catch this stuff, because it's not just I'm guessing that virtually everybody in this room, racism, not, you know, I'm not interested in that. It's abhorrent to me. And but look at the why these folks are employing it. So when you're getting abused by the press department, and we like to tell jokes in our office about an interesting encounter we had with Hope Hicks that I won't quote here. But when this happens, there's a whole mindset behind that. This is a guy who is willing to grab women by the genitals and then boast about it. That's abusive. This is a guy who's willing to just sort of throw towels out to Puerto Ricanos and move on, and that's abusive. So when we're looking and dealing with these sources, and maybe I'm covering some old ground that we've already touched here, we're looking at people who are being abused by their system. It's not just that there's a political correctness, or I really appreciate you bringing up how the Obama White House and what they were doing to go after leaks and the kind of subpoenas and the secret stuff that they did, moving us closer to a police state, is really rather alarming. They have given, actually, the Trump administration an apparatus to do this kind of stuff that wasn't there before. But I never had the impression from the Obama crowd that it was abusive. They're playing hardball, but there's a difference between hardball and abusing. So what we can bring the public is some salve for these wounds that are being cut into our society. We can bring forth the good news. We can bring forth the steps that people can take. We can hold up, we can lift up the people who are in the midst of this making a difference. And I think that that's something that that we really need to do. So just when you're out there covering this stuff, look around. See how folks are being abused by the present system and respond to that, whether it involves racism or not.
So.
No one can ever follow you.
That's hard to follow. Speaking of abuse, this administration is also very abusive of reporters, and several of our reporters up here have dealt with that personally. How are you dealing with that? I mean, there's the sort of public generalized bashing of the press and, you know, the idea that we're all just fake news if you don't like the message. But then there's also just private and sometimes public bashing of individual reporters. So, Michael, what do you think about that?
How did I know you were coming to me? This administration does not play by the traditional rules of how reporters deal with agencies in Washington. You know, there's these gentlemen's agreements, for lack of a better term, definitely a sexist term, but it's been around a long time, about, you know, if you're talking to a flack, typically what they say on the record is going to be truthful. At least in past administrations, you couldn't obviously just take, it might be a lie of omission, it would be from their perspective, but they're not just going to out-tell you something that's not true. And one thing that the administration currently does is they will refuse to give you information that you ask for or give you incomplete information, and then when you write based on that, come back and either demand a correction or accuse you of fake news because you didn't include something that they didn't give you. Or in my case, they gave you a document that they came back 2 days later and said that document wasn't accurate. So you just got to be especially wary in dealing with this administration that, you have to wonder, are they trying to set you up for something down the road? Are they putting you in a position where they're going to talk to Breitbart and have them do a hit piece on you? It's definitely a different environment than we've worked in. And again, caution is the norm of the day. You know, any mistake or perceived mistake will be so magnified and used against you that, we all have good habits about accuracy, but man, today, take that extra minute, take a deep breath, make sure that what you're reporting is checked four different ways and bulletproof, because They are looking for you to get something not quite right.
I mean, I agree totally with caution and being careful. And when it comes to criticism or being called fake news or an enemy of the state, I mean, my basic reaction to that is, like, who gives a shit? I mean, if you're fair and you're honest and you do good work, that kind of speaks for itself. And I was struck earlier this year when our editor was asked about covering the Trump administration, and kind of, I think the way it was phrased to him was, what's it like to, like, go up against the Trump administration? And he said, you know, we're not at war, we're at work. And as long as you do your work, that probably speaks the loudest of anything.
I mean, what I think really worries me is not just the way that the agencies or the political appointees deal with reporters in Washington, but the treatment of reporters on the ground covering stories related to the environment. You know, you had reporters covering what was going on in Standing Rock who were abused by the police, who were arrested for doing their jobs. And as I think Stephen was saying, there's sort of this undercurrent of racism or abuse. So really what most concerns me about this administration, I think, is the way that independent or non-white journalists who are covering these environmental issues on the ground are treated both by, I guess, federal agencies or law enforcement, and then I also think that filters down to the local level.
So I thought Lisa had a great way of handling it in the story this week. You guys included a quote from the administration that they didn't want to respond to your question because it was just an attempt to sensationalize for clicks. And you included that in the story so that it was kind of made it more transparent for readers, like how they're reacting to basic questions. So I don't know, can you speak about like why you decided to include that in the story and, you know, yeah, how you're dealing with it?
Sure. I mean, the story was, you know, one of, and you know, we've seen many now stories on Scott Pruitt's schedule, and the response that we got from the administration was, you know, that this was an attempt, as you said, to sensationalize for clicks. And, you know, I mean, we put it in the story because that was their response. That was, you know, and I would say that many responses that we get to stories involve some version of deriding the newspaper in the quote, in the response. And so, you know, so, I mean, A, my feeling is give the administration its due. If that's what they want to say, then put it in. You know, I think, but just going back to sort of the broader attacks, I mean, it has really struck me also sort of the new world that we are in, of, you know, the assistance that the administration gets in attacking mainstream journalists. I mean, you know, for a long time, I think they changed it, but there were certain news releases that went not to us, but, you know, to the Daily Caller and Breitbart that were, you know, attacks on, you know, on Michael, on Eric Lipton at you know, my colleague, the New York Times, that were basically some version of the media was wrong and the administrator was right at EPA. And, you know, and so you are dealing now not just with, you know, an administration that is on the attack, but a whole system of media engage in helping to further that.
And just to piggyback a little, you have to look at where the people working in this administration came from, right? The spokeswoman for the Environmental Protection Agency came straight from the American Chemistry Council. She was the top spokeswoman for the chemical industry. So some of the tactics they're using are straight from the corporate crisis communications playbook of, if you can't discredit the story, if you can't find one little scintilla of thing that you can claim is wrong, then attack the reporter and try to discredit the outlet and say that they're biased against you. And, you know, we're all professionals here. We're reporters. We have skins like gators, right? We're tough people. So you shrug that off and you move on to the next story, because it's not just that story that they're trying to discredit. They're trying to discredit the next story you do. and the story after that. That's what they're concerned about. And they very much want to control the message. And if they don't feel they can control you or your message, then they're going to attack you.
I had a very similar situation to Lisa's story. Last night, actually, I got a scoop on some details of the Clean Power Plan, and the response that I got back was essentially, you know, since you're reporting on rumors now, here's our statement. And we decided to put the whole statement in because that's what EPA wants their statement to be. That is their public position, and it is part of the story. You could easily have, you know, clipped that out and just had the statement part, but that is a big part of this. And I think it's awkward for us because we've always been told, keep yourself out of the story. And now we are part of the story, and we have to figure out how, like, we clearly shouldn't cover that ourselves. Like, I would never write a story on, like, how I am treated by various agencies. But definitely we should be looking to media reporters to be telling people how that's going. But I think it's hard because we don't want to look like we're whining, right? Because we can take it. It's not about being upset when you get an angry phone call or, you know, being in a story focusing on your reporting. Like, that's okay. That's part of our job, for people to check what we're doing and see if we're doing a good job of that. It's just, you know, will that distract from the important things we want to tell people about at a time when, I mean, I haven't looked this morning, but I assume if you go to Politico's main page right now, a lot of the top stories are not about the environment. It's very hard to capture people's attention on this right now. And my editors are very interested in that, but we have stories coming out about, you know, whether we could go to war with North Korea, you know, whether a lot of people will lose their health insurance soon, whether people's friends and families, you know, could be deported. And there's a lot of uncertainty about all of those policies. So I think we have to drill down, but also take a bigger picture in a lot of our stories here to tell people, you know, this might not be something you think you have time to think about, but it could matter. This could be life or death for you, depending on the policy.
You know, through history, it's been a practice of rulers to shoot the messenger, right? We're losing this war, fine. Off with his head. So this is nothing new. This is the 2017 version with a particularly difficult guy who'd rather be emperor than president of a democracy. But inside our democracy, there are a couple of really wonderful checkpoints that are great sources for stories. So let's look at the Clean Power Plan kerfuffle going on right now. Pruitt has got a tap dance to a tune that the Circuit Court of Appeals is playing right now. If he wants to take out the Clean Power Rule, he's got to put in something that matches what the court demands. And talking about what the process is of this, not only the legal precedents have been set, but literally the rulemaking process here is a powerful way to point to the smoke and mirrors that's coming from the agency. As much as they may want to just pull it back, they cannot. They have to do this substitute, the amount of time that they have to do, and all that. And so it's optics. It's just trying to feed the base. Yeah, we're trying to get rid of this thing, which is a job killer, because you're not going to be able to sell coal. I mean, where do we interrupt that string of sort of fantasy or delusion? But the courts are a really great place, and court activity, which can be boring, and the benches are really hard always in the courthouse, and it's really difficult to get interesting leaks out of the courts. But judges have friends, and friends will discreetly talk. But you must completely protect these people. You must. But I have to tell you that, you know, Richard Lazarus, who's at Harvard Law School, was a roommate with Chief Justice Roberts. And he covers the environment. He's an environmental lawyer. So I watch Dick's body language. Every time I encounter him for a story, I look, you know, the slightest eyebrow tells me something, right? Because there I can get an insight. And sometimes it's not a lead, it's not a classic leak, but it's a lead. Look here. The other place in our government, which is a great source on this climate story, is the military. These guys are very serious about it. Now, Admiral Titley is retired, and he's off at Penn State, I think, with Michael Mann, but still inside the Pentagon, and that group is in touch with what's going on in the Pentagon. There's a lot that's being done about security, climate, And the pushback, by the way, on Paris, in part, is the military. And these are folks who have not succumbed to, more than the usual spin. I mean, everyone has got a spin to something. We've always gotten that from people in a statement. They spin the truth as best as they can stay truthful, as you pointed out. And the military crowd so far and the court crowd so far have not crossed over that line to just give you the outright lie. But like all these other sources, if they're giving you hot stuff, you really got to protect them. But these are places we can look.
So I have one more moderator question, and then I want to start with audience questions. So if you have a question, you can start gathering at the microphone while they answer my last one. And just a reminder that the questions will go first to reporters, and then anyone else in the room will come after that. So my last moderator question is, you know, most of us here are in Washington, Stevens in Boston, and Peter's in New York, but a lot of our members here are regional reporters. They're out across the country. They're in states. They're in cities and towns. So what is your advice for them on covering this administration? Where should they be looking for ideas and ways to get in?
I would say don't be reactionary, right? Don't just report on what agencies are doing. Report on what they're not doing. So look for the things that should have been coming, you know, status reports, information about different projects. Talk to people who used to run these agencies to get a sense of what they think could be going wrong, because often there's a lot in the weeds that would be really important to your community that we're never going to cover, even though we know it's important just because it can be a little too incremental, but it could really get policymakers engaged where you are.
I would say maybe it's early for this because there's not a real budget, just a proposed budget, but keep an eye out for money that doesn't come, you know, and some of that may already be playing out with grants or whatever that the EPA has decided not to renew. So kind of to Emily's point, look for the ripple effects from Washington. That's where real people, obviously, as we all know, get affected.
Also, the states are often used as laboratories for federal policy later on. So especially depending on what state you're in, policies that are now emerging in Washington may have been tried in your state first. Did it work? What were the results? Are they recycling a policy that didn't have the best results in your state and now trying to implement it on a federal level?
Also, local or statewide or regional environmental organizations, the ones that constantly filling up your inbox with emails and wanting you to come to all these sessions that you wonder what the value is, they do spend 24/7 looking at these, as you describe, right, these ripple effects out of Washington. And so while they have their own agendas and their own particular thing that they're trying to sell, take a listen, because there can be really interesting leads from those folks, because they will, in some of the agencies, I think that the scientists and the bureaucrats feel a little more comfortable talking to enviros because they've been back and forth sometimes in these agencies. They feel a little more comfortable talking to them than reaching directly to us in the press. Obviously, an abundance of caution in dealing with these people, but they can be important sources.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what else I can add to all these great suggestions, but, all of these policy issues are fundamentally local issues, and I think, in some cases, for example, the decision on the monuments, I think a lot of local officials in Utah and other places had a lot of good information earlier than some of us did in Washington, and so not only is there a way to, cover a lot of good issues locally, but you can get a jump on Washington by getting close to county commissioners and others who, are close to the administration or working on policy measures, in Washington.
And of course, make sure that you're always putting it in the context of how it affects local people in your community, because if the powers that be in Washington are trying to portray reporters as fake news and say that they're lying and they can't be trusted, then I think that by doing good investigative reporting on what the people in your community are going to face, that will build trust. And then hopefully your audience will trust you more because you're speaking to them than, you know, the people in D.C., the political appointees who want to demonize the media.
Right. I mean, like every local paper, I think, should be looking at their Superfund sites right now and, you know, and how much funding they should be getting. Will they be getting it? And I mean, those kinds of stories.
Any black grants and, you know, there's so many.
Yeah. Yeah.
Water systems.
And a lot of those things are very important to Republicans in Congress, too, and they are eager to talk about how much they want them to be funded, and they want those things to continue.
I was just going to say, clean air and clean water are issues that, across political lines, people care about. The more you can tell the stories of people dealing with the national issue that you're writing about, like if it's coal ash waste pits and what that's putting into waterways, you know, find the woman that lives next door to that coal ash pit who's scared to drink from her well and makes her sweet tea with bottled water because of arsenic. Those people are out there, and if you can find them and tell their stories, that's powerful.
Great. So we can go to audience questions. The microphone is up here at the front. And just state your name and any affiliation you have. And I just preference reporters first, but I can't see the color of your name tag, so I'm going to trust Dale.
Hi, this is Arielle Breen. I'm with the Gaylord Herald Times in Northern Michigan. I just had a really quick question. I think this is for Steve Kerwood. So you said to bring salve to the public for the wounds that the administration had kind of brought to us. What does that mean, or what would some of those examples of salve be?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear what you said.
So you had said to bring salve to the wounds that Washington had kind of made. What would be some examples of that salve that we can bring to the public?
Well, let's say in a community you have an effective, let's talk about water. If things are moving forward to deal with the watershed and improve water quality, or to deal with the difficult pollution situation in the community, lift that up. Let people know that, in fact, progress is being made. One of the burdens of this business is that it's usually a quicker and easier story to talk about conflict and something that's gone wrong, to wag a finger. And we're sort of a little bit allergic to doing more positive stories sometimes because we're afraid they're PR. But in fact, people need hope in these times. And so where there's a good, legitimate story that in fact shows progress, and it may just be a coalition that's getting built to do something, or something has moved forward in some ways, then don't be afraid to tell that story.
I would add there's a really interesting study recently on climate change and how it's discussed in the media that found that there really just two things that readers care about in climate change stories that motivate them, that interest them. And one is hope, so sort of solutions journalism, telling them there's a way that the global community might be able to keep this from happening. And the other is fear. And I think we can write about both of those things. You know, but when you write about fear, you know, sometimes the story is more bad than it is good. We do have to tell that. And it might make us look very pessimistic, but I think that's important to be honest with our readers about, too.
Next question.
I'm Daniela Cheslow, and I'm an editor at NPR. And my question for any one of you is, how do you use Twitter as a way to cultivate your online presence and sources without being snarky in a way that would alienate the very folks that you're covering?
We always talk about this.
Twitter.
Yeah.
Lisa's great on Twitter.
Well, I think Twitter is like the most fun invention in years, and I'm so glad it exists. And I mean, there's the dangers and there's the drawbacks and the benefits. The benefits, I think, so far outweigh the, you know, I mean, we use it to promote stories, obviously. We also use it to engage with readers and with sources. You know, my colleague Brad Plummer is great at, you know, having sort of in-depth geeking out discussions with, you know, with energy policy analysts and you know, experts on nuclear and transmission about, you know, about energy transition issues. I've found scientists through Twitter. I've found people that I, you know, I have found the nephew of someone that I, you know, needed to try to get to, and you know, who helped me get in touch with the person I needed. On the other hand, yes, you know, you do always have to be careful. And I think we're always walking that line. I mean, I just had a conversation with my editor the other day about, you know, should we be tweeting things that we have rejected doing a story on, which is really tough because sometimes you know things and and you want to tweet them. And so I don't know. I think that's like an ongoing discussion and conversation with your newsroom and how you want to handle it. You know, I try to be not snarky on Twitter. I think that it is, you know, I think it ultimately does a disservice to a reporter your Twitter account, your Facebook page is an extension of your professional self, and you know, and yes, you can be freer, but I think that you still need to be careful to maintain an objectivity on even on Twitter, even though it's hard.
I think that the real risk with Twitter, particularly if you're a journalist, is that you will write and tweet for other journalists. And not necessarily for your audience, or your sources who may not be on Twitter. Now, I have a slightly different perspective because I primarily cover the media, so my sources are journalists, so engaging with them on Twitter is actually very helpful. But if you're not covering the media, then you should not be spending a lot of your time just kind of, you know, trading jokes and links and references with other journalists.
Yeah, I mean, I think as fraught as Twitter can be sometimes, it can also be a good tool, a good reporting tool. I mean, we saw David Fahrenthold do this really well with the Trump foundations to kind of crowdsource that. And in small ways, I've tried to do the same. Like, if you're looking for a document or you're looking for answers to a certain question, like, it can't hurt to blast it out to the universe. And so you can find people that way. You can kind of in real time workshop a lead or a headline, or, you know, like, because it's just there and gone on Twitter, and you can kind of gauge how people are going to react to something. So I think it also can be a tool.
I would just add that I never put anything on Twitter that I wouldn't, if the occasion called for it, include in the broadcast. That it's at that standard. You know, I have to feel comfortable. It could be printed anyplace or broadcast anyplace. Having said that, it's a terrific tool. For example, at the big climate meetings internationally, where there's like a zillion people gathered and a thousand things happening simultaneously, Twitter is really the only way to navigate in real time.
Actually, that's a great point. I mean, one of the ways I use Twitter often is to fact-check things, right? Like, I thought I remembered, you know, Pruitt saying X at a, you know, at a speech, and I, you know, go back and do a search, and like, yep, Emily was there, and she live tweeted that he said that. Now I can go and look on my, find it on my tape, you know. By the way, everyone should follow Kate Shepard. She's really funny.
I shouldn't tweet that much anymore because I'm too busy editing content. We actually have the opposite problem: not getting people to tweet rejected ideas, but getting reporters who tweet something that's a smart and insightful thing, and we're like, why didn't you write that as an article? Why did you put that on Twitter? So we sometimes use it as a testing ground for interesting story ideas.
That's hard with a paywall, too, because you have to ask yourself, if I tweet this, am I taking away from value that we're providing readers who are paying for this service that is very important to them? Some of my stuff goes in front of a paywall, but not all of it. And I think it's right to think of your tweets as stories, mini stories, essentially. Like look at the president's tweets. I don't know if you've seen the website that basically puts them in press release form. I think that would be a good thing for us to do too, right? Like, would I be okay with this being printed on my company's website, you know, as a story with my byline on it? But I also think you don't want to be too cold on social media. Some of my best sources are people, I've met, you know, e-met, I guess, on Twitter, who could see some of my personality, and we traded messages back and forth and traded gossip and laughed about stuff, and now they're people that I talk to pretty routinely. So I don't know. I tend to follow people who are fun, too. I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, that's the same. I find that it's been helpful to have, like, somewhat of a personality. I mean, I don't say things I wouldn't say in public or on an article, but having someone personality makes people be like, oh, she's not a robot.
And that goes for instant messaging on social media platforms, Facebook and Twitter as well, just because it's direct message to someone. Don't ever put anything in a direct message that you wouldn't be comfortable being exposed later on. I have a sign on my desk that says, dance like no one is watching, but write like it may someday be read aloud in a deposition. Because nothing is ever really private anymore, and it's good to remember that, especially as you get casual on social media with people.
Great. Next question.
Yeah. I'm Christy George. I'm a freelance radio public radio news editor in Oregon. And I have a Twitter question as well. Yesterday, Donald J. Trump, at Real Donald J. Trump, tweeted, why isn't the Senate Intel Committee looking into the fake news networks in our country to see why so much of our news is just made up fake? This is being taken seriously last night on the cable news network, CNN and MSNBC, who've come under so much fire. But I wonder if, I mean, they're taking seriously the prospect that some Intel committee may, not necessarily Senate, but some Intel committee and maybe the government itself will start investigating them. And I wonder if you or your newsrooms, any of you, are taking this seriously.
Michael, you talked about it a little earlier.
Absolutely, we take it seriously, primarily to protect our sources and to protect ourselves. I mean, you know, this is relatively new in American history. Not that there's sometimes an adversarial role set up by an administration attacking the press. Certainly other presidents have done it, but not to this degree, not to where the chief executive of the United States is en masse attacking reporters as purveyors of fake news and setting up this us versus them. If you like me, you can't like them. If you support me, you can't read them sort of dichotomy. And you know, yeah, it's while it's easy to say, who cares, we sort of have to. He's the president, and the president is attacking us en masse. I'm not familiar with another example where that's happened in modern American history.
Yeah, I would definitely be concerned. I don't think that the Senate Intel Committee is necessarily going to investigate fake news in the sense of reporting that President Trump or the agencies deemed to be false. But they will absolutely potentially investigate leaks to reporters. Pretty much no one in D.C. In a position of power defends leaks. Even people who oppose Trump, Jim Comey, you know, when he was talking with Donald Trump, and Trump said, oh, you know, we have to go after the leakers. Why aren't they in jail? You know, he said that he told the president, oh, you know, yes, leaks are a problem. Like, it's definitely possible that we could see the Intel committees try to investigate leaks, especially of classified information, to the media. Historically, I believe the Congressional Intel Committees have only subpoenaed a reporter once to testify about leaks.
Well, and two, what's a leak? I wrote recently, and I know some of you did as well, that at cabinet agencies, they were forced to kind of take anti-leak training. And that training conflated things that are illegal for people to leak, classified information, things that there's legal protections for that information, that it shouldn't make it into the public realm and shouldn't be given to reporters, and then what they called uncontrolled but sensitive information. And that's basically anything that they say it is. And when that's treated in the same way, that it's going to be investigated, that you'll be punished for something that is a public record. Essentially we're talking about government employees getting in trouble for giving you government documents that aren't classified. And again, that's different.
I'm sorry. you said this is unprecedented in American history. I just want to remind folks that if you go back and look at the Watergate history, the crew that broke into the DNC were called plumbers because Nixon was obsessed with leaks. And that's who E. Howard Hunt and all those guys were called, plumbers. So that White House turned out to be a criminal enterprise. History may show that the present White House turns out to be a criminal enterprise. And if we're going to have a free press, it involves us taking risks to nonetheless expose the wrongdoing that's going on, even when it is, quote, illegal. I'm old enough to remember when it was illegal for a black person to marry a white person. I am old enough to remember that it was illegal for two people of the same sex to get married. So the question of what is legal and what is moral sometimes is not the same. And it's our duty, it's enshrined in the Constitution of the United States that we have a press, and sometimes we have to look past what seemingly is the law to what the real law is, what the moral law, and what our responsibility is.
And the legality, you know, this distinction between legal leaks or illegal leaks is not really established in law. The Espionage Act is written so broadly that it could potentially cover anything that impacted national security, which includes a lot of things that are not necessarily classified. For most of the history of the law, leaks to the media were not considered legal. They were not prosecuted. It was only very recently, really under the Obama administration, that you started to see a lot of leakers be prosecuted for giving information to the media. Now, the Obama administration only went after people who leaked classified information. I guess the argument being that this information was controlled, and so it was illegal to leak it under the Espionage Act. But again, the Espionage Act is so broad that the decision to only go after people who leak classified information is not so much a legal distinction as it is a precedent, like a norm. Theoretically, if Attorney General Sessions wanted to, he could likely prosecute government employees for leaking information that was not actually classified, or could even try to prosecute journalists for publishing information that was not classified. That's never happened before. It hopefully won't, but the law is pretty unsettled at this point.
I think, just to add one quick thing, that what both of you said was really important, and it underscores that while journalists may take risks, you always have to keep in mind that the people leaking to you are taking perhaps a bigger risk, and that you have a real obligation to protect them.
The 2 points I was going to make was also there's the creep of classification, where the people who are deciding what is classified can classify lots of things that probably shouldn't be classified. And then there's the other point was that there are whistleblowers, you know, who should have some protections. And so that's the difference between leakers and whistleblowers, who there is some level of protection that's probably not enough. But what are we doing to make sure that they don't feel like they can't do that anymore because they're afraid of recourse?
And something that we always have to remember is the vast majority of the documents produced by the government are public records. They're ours. They belong to the American people. So someone giving you a government document that's not classified, it's not a crime. The administration may be able to talk about it like it's one, but again, this is information that should be in the public realm, and it's our tax dollars at work. It belongs to us anyway, so don't act like we're getting something we're not supposed to.
I'd say that the genre of story that is a leak about the not leaking is my favorite genre of story, usually when it includes a slide of saying that you shouldn't leak. It's great. Anyway, next question.
Craig Miller, KQED San Francisco. Point was made earlier that the previous administration didn't win any prizes either for access. We had a lot of trouble with NOAA and Forest Service and other agencies under Obama. Now we're starting to see it at the state level, too. I'm wondering if some of what we're seeing it doesn't reflect a more general permanent shift away from access and accountability from government agencies, and if so, what do we do about that besides spend all of our time filing Public Records Act requests?
And waiting 6 months for them to come back or never come back.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
When they come back, you've forgotten what you asked for.
Be ready to sue. If you file a FOIA, you know, pay attention to those deadlines. When that 30 days passes, if they've not taken out, prepare to file your administrative appeal. And if that doesn't work, be prepared to go to court. I mean, you know, most news organizations have had to beef up their First Amendment legal apparatuses, have in-house legal counsel. And most of the things that are coming out through FOIA are things that people had to fight in court to get. So be prepared to do that.
I would say this is not a complete you know, answer or doesn't solve the entire problem. But, you know, I guess the short way to say it is go around them. Look at things that agencies, state, local, federal, have to file, have to disclose, whether it's reports or regulations that, you know, by statute they have to say what they want to do. Again, it kind of goes to the idea of actions and not words. I mean, the federal government, every agency has to say how it's spending money, both on grants but also within the agency. So like any third-party contract is a public document that just gets updated in this database. You might even find like a privacy booth for the EPA administrator if you look in there. But there are things that exist out there that, you know, they have to kind of give clues to where they are headed, whether it's a state or federal agency, and it's good to stay on top of those.
And just to piggyback on that a little bit, a lot of things that you're looking for with one agency, if they don't answer you, another agency might have that information. When we were reporting about flooding at Superfund sites after Hurricane Harvey, EPA wasn't saying, you know, what might have leaked from these sites, but lo and behold, there's a Coast Guard hotline that people have to call by law to report spills, and they have a public log, and in that log was reports of spills at Superfund sites that EPA had not answered questions about. So think of creative ways to find the information you're looking for, maybe in unexpected places.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Vero Valderas. I am a reporter for Voice of America, made in Mexico. And I just want to ask you guys and everybody here whether you are actually doing everything you can to reach out to Spanish-speaking audiences in the U.S. and, you know, people who follow you in the internet. You know, do you have actually robust teams of Spanish-speaking experienced journalists that are reaching out to those communities that culturally we are not really aware of environmental matters? And if you're not doing that, why so?
I think it's a really important and good question. I will say that some stories we've done, particularly international stories, we often run in, and I know that you guys have done this as well, run in languages in the country in which it's based. I think we could do a lot more of that, even for domestic stories.
It's been a challenge for us. We've teamed with WIPR, which is public radio in Puerto Rico, for some projects. Teaming up with them, and they can generate stories. But, you know, I haven't yet figured out how to do in real time bilingual radio. But someday, perhaps, maybe a babblefish will do the trick.
I have the benefit of working for a truly international news organization that have native speakers in languages around the world, and our content gets translated into those languages and distributed in those worlds. In those countries. But the main thing I look for is ways to pair with other reporters, both domestically and internationally, that can tell untold stories in, you know, beyond the U.S. And we have an environmental beat team that includes international members from Asia, Latin America, and Europe that we have a weekly call where we pitch story ideas and how to tell it from around the world. And some of the best work that AP's generated in recent years were multinational collaborations between reporters in different countries. Seafood for Slaves, that won the Pulitzer Prize last year, was a collaboration between reporters in the States and reporters in Asia. So we're always looking for ways to collaborate with reporters, not just Spanish language reporters, but reporters around the world.
Yeah, we also were lucky we have a partner site in Mexico. I'd love to expand our Spanish language capabilities in our newsroom. We have a few Spanish speakers, but I'd like to hire more and get more people trained in basic Spanish, because I think it's kind of a crucial key for reporting in a lot of parts of the country right now. Next question.
Hi, I'm Joe Davis, and I mostly work for SCJ, and I'm happy that the panel is focused mostly on how individual reporters and news desks can respond to the current administration. I'm interested in whether there's enough collective and collaborative action on pushing back. And this isn't a softball for Peter Stern, because my real question is, and can we be doing more? And I know there's a fabric of organizations, but are they working together well enough to really respond to this?
I mean, like, are news organizations working together
well? Well, let's say, like, the Reporters Committee is one example. But are the news organizations as well working? There was a time long ago and far away when the AP had a very strong activist kind of program on open information. Well, they still do. I'm not, no aspersions, but they took a more out there political role, let's just say.
Basically, rather than us being divided between ourselves, but are we working together to push for transparency and access and all those things that we collectively care about?
I mean, just anecdotally, I would, because I'm not deeply involved in groups that are, you know, that are pressing for more access, but anecdotally, I would say, you know, increasingly we're partnering with, you know, with other news organizations like ProPublica to get access to documents, to do the important stories that need to be done. And I do think, you know, again, anecdotally, there is certainly, especially on this beat, and that's the one I can speak best to, sort of a, you know, less of a sense of competition. We're always competing, but also, you know, more of a group sense of like, okay, we're all being stonewalled. How do we do this? And so, I think that is new and important and gratifying to see.
I think there's a big difference between pushing for transparency, however we have to in organizational ways, and doing that very publicly. And I think that news organizations as a whole are still trying to figure out what they can come out and say together about what we're dealing with this administration and whether it's normal and how it compares to previous administrations, which we also had some issues with, but very different kinds of issues. But I just don't think that we've answered that question yet, and I think that we'll really continue to struggle with that. I know it's something that Politico thinks about a lot, and we have a lot of internal discussions about, and the editors are concerned about. But I started a few months ago, so I couldn't say specifically what their position is on it.
And there's unfortunately you come down to a really difficult problem for us as journalists, because what is journalism today? How legitimate is an organization like Breitbart, for example? Should we be working with them? And I could get on my device here and I could find a new online news organization I'd never heard of today. So are we operating with a sort of a guild mentality that if you are from these curated, edited organizations, they're sort of the way that, quote, we have done it for all these years, that's okay, and we shouldn't be collaborating with people who aren't from that world? Peter, you've raised a really difficult situation, because today it's unclear what is journalism. What is journalism? And, what did the founding fathers envision when they talked about having a free press? And for a bit of amusement, by the way, you can go back in history and look at the absolutely scandalous, outrageous, crazy things that were written around the Revolutionary War in the early years of this country. It makes Breitbart, for example, look pretty tame, some of the stuff that was said. But still, this is something that we talk about, and, you know, within folks that we feel that are part of our circle at Living on Earth, of course we work with ProPublica, a great story with Lisa Song. She must be here today, I think. Wonderful stuff. When we wanted to go to Houston and look at what was going on with Superfund and such, we're working with Texas Trib and all that, because we have to collaborate, given the squeeze on resources and that so much is happening. But what do we consider a journalism organization? I mean, that's a tough one. And I am concerned that I may be excluding people who are working in this area because I may be skeptical of their, I hate to say it, their politics.
So I'm less concerned about, what we consider a news organization to be and whether they're legitimate or not. I think that when we're talking about collaboration in terms of strengthening protections for journalists or making it easier to obtain public records, then what matters is whether their interests are the same as ours. And it's difficult because news organizations do have interests that they should probably try to advance by, in part, lobbying to strengthen FOIA laws or to get a federal shield law or anti-SLAPP law passed. But you need to make sure that it's obviously awkward to have journalists covering politicians and then also have the news organizations that employ those journalists lobbying, which doesn't mean that the news organizations should not assert their interests and try to strengthen laws protecting journalists, but it does mean that there needs to be a very clear divide between the business or institutional side of the news organization that is pushing for laws to change and reporters who are covering politicians.
And there's actually, also ways to... I'm sorry, but I was just curious, I mean, since you covered the media more in depth, I mean, have you seen, like, we've always struggled with this as an industry, right? And but, like, has the Trump administration changed the direction of news organizations as a whole to lobby harder or be more cohesive in demanding protections, or are we still kind of figuring out?
No, I definitely don't think they have. I think, if anything, probably the Obama administration prompted more collaboration between news outlets and nonprofit groups like Reporters Committee. Obviously, the Reporters Committee led a group that included the Post and I believe the Times in essentially negotiating with the Department of Justice about what the guidelines should be for subpoenaing reporters. And I think they just met with Rod Rosenstein recently because Jeff Sessions said that he was considering reviewing or scaling back those guidelines, which would mean that under the current guidelines, which were implemented after the DOJ took your phone records, now the Department of Justice or the FBI needs to notify news organizations before they subpoena records, giving the news organizations a chance to fight it in court. And that was something that news outlets and the Reporters Committee and other groups pushed for. And now they are trying to make sure that it doesn't get rolled back. I think you also see a lot of the nonprofit groups pushing for a federal shield law that would protect reporters from having to disclose their sources in front of grand juries, and potentially a federal anti-SLAPP law that would make it easier to dismiss frivolous libel and defamation claims. But no, to answer your question, I don't think that we've seen for-profit news organizations really start banding together to assert their interests, in part probably because the government right now is not very receptive to news organizations lobbying. But I do think it's something that news organizations should do and probably increasingly will do.
Also, unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. This has been a great conversation, and there's tons more to say, and I'm sure it will be said over the course of the other panels and events in the next 2 days, but thank you guys so much for being here. I know that you're all busy, and there was probably a lot of news that we missed in the last hour and a half, so good luck to you in catching up. Thank you, guys.